Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya, on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
Unfortunately, what it is doing is instilling negative stereotypes, which is really quite harmful to the low vision and blindness community. Where in 2025, you wouldn't expect that you'd be coming across challenges like this on social media.
The spread of a viral social media hashtag targeting people who are blind has sparked outrage amongst the disability community. Also, the Gen Z protest movement has seen a major increase worldwide, with younger generations rallying over discontent with government. But advocacy groups have raised concerns over heavy-handed responses from authorities. And later...
The uterus was responding to the ovarian hormones and then could actually develop an endometrial lining and then have a period. That was a massive milestone and, you know, lots of tears. And she sort of said, gosh, I never thought I'd be so happy to have a period.
2023 saw a healthy baby boy brought to term via the nation's first uterus transplant. 2 years on, we hear insights from one of the medical team. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, Australia's inaugural Renter Confidence Index demonstrates broad concern surrounding Victoria's rental landscape and its 1.5 million renters, from lease increases, complaints processes, and renting standards. The RCI was launched earlier this week by the Consumer Policy Research Centre at Parliament House, together with the Victorian Minister for Consumer Affairs and industry representatives. The RCI was developed as a new tool to guide regulation and reform. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Shandini Gupta, Deputy CEO and Digital Policy Director at the Consumer Policy Research Centre.
So renting is very much front of mind, not only in Victoria, but nationally. Renting should be seen as an essential service. And like any essential service, you need to be able to measure what matters. So the Renter Confidence Index, it's really a systematic way to measure how renters are really faring that goes beyond anecdotes and assumptions.
It was launched at State Parliament yesterday afternoon with Victorian Consumer Affairs Minister Nick Stakos and industry representatives. Has there been any response or reception to it so far?
So far, it's been received really positively. And what we're seeing is that people, whether it's advocates, it's industry, it's government, they're all looking at how they can use the insights from the research to help move the rental market forward and ensure that it continues to be fairer, safer, and inclusive for all.
What are you hoping the publication could potentially set in motion for the rest of the country?
Ideally, what we'd like to see is that renter confidence is measured across Australia. We would love to be able to do this study across different states and territories, because it would be really important to measure something so many people rely on. And renting is no longer just a stepping stone into a housing or purchasing a house. There are forever renters. And so we need to ensure that renting becomes as good a service as it possibly can be. But you can only do that if you measure how it's performing and how reforms around it are actually delivering impact for people who rent.
Almost 4 in 5 renters had encountered at least one significant tenancy issue in the past 12 months. Can you elaborate on the reality of these concerns?
So what we found that Victorian renters are experiencing challenges throughout their rental journey, from application to eviction. There's been considerable amount of issues raised in terms of delays in maintenance and repairs. And then we've also had issues right up till the end where it's related to evictions. This is what has caused some of the biggest concerns for people. And the one aspect that comes through even more is that when you are facing that challenge, 2 in 5 who do, unfortunately, stay silent. They either endure the issue or they simply move. And there's a real fear of retaliation. obligation and not wanting to rock the boat. So one of the things we found was that 42% of renters are being asked to provide far more information than they should. And it was from full bank statements to sexual orientation to previous tribunal complaints, medical records to cultural background. It's not appropriate and it's not necessary. And that particular part of the application process, because you're filling it out, you're going to complete everything that is being asked of you because you want to be able to have the home, it's one that really needs to be considered, because we really saw you're being asked for far more information than what's legally obligated for you to provide.
What does it mean for Victorians to be pushed back into the rental market if they lose their home they're in? Are there any recommendations for addressing concerns that they have to agents and landlords without having fears of repercussions?
So Victoria actually has some of the strongest rental laws. What we've seen is there's a broader challenge that even where legal protections exist, renters may not feel safe or supported to use them. And yesterday at the launch, we heard from a renter who spoke about the decision that you actually need to make between raising your voice and then potentially having to leave that place and enduring a higher rent because of the market that's currently there and the market that people are currently experiencing at the moment. So it really is about working together in the ecosystem to help lift the confidence of renters and support them in exercising their rights.
Shantani Gupta, Deputy CEO and Digital Policy Director at the Consumer Policy Research Centre, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Several people who are blind or have low vision have called on social media giants to embrace stricter guidelines and protections against circulating harmful content. This comes in the wake of a new trend that gained online popularity. The viral social media hashtags Blind Challenge and Blind Kid Challenge prompted users without disability to imitate and mock members of the blind community for entertainment, viewership, and social engagement. That's according to Guide Dogs New South Wales ACT. Powered Media's Emma Myers spoke with Tamara Sergeant, General Manager of Social Change at Guide Dogs New South Wales ACT, who said the trend is a step backwards for the blind community.
My name is Tamara Sergeant and my position is General Manager of Social Change.
Tamara, tell me a little bit about this specific social media trend and why it's confronting and a bit of a backward step for the community.
So unfortunately, we became aware of this trend where there are hashtags like hashtag blind challenge and hashtag blind kid challenge. And unfortunately, it's a social media trend where parents ask their children to act like someone with low vision or blindness. Unfortunately, what it is doing is instilling negative stereotypes, which is really quite harmful to the low vision and blindness community. Where in 2025, you wouldn't expect that you'd be coming across challenges like this on social media. So when we were made aware that this was happening on the 10th of October, we jumped straight on it to say we need to do a campaign against this.
And is it a big thing here in Australia, because I know it's huge over in America?
It is quite a big trend in America, in the US. It hasn't necessarily had the same level of pickup here in Australia, but there are some parents jumping on it. Our mission is to do our best to educate people now before more people jump on the challenge. As soon as we heard about it, we contacted the social media companies. We've been told that they are reviewing the issue. So we made sure it went to their communications and trust and safety team so that they can actually address it directly. We've also built out a campaign page where we're highlighting our position on this and that it isn't acceptable and that we need to make sure that these kind of trends are not something that we need to have in 2025. We have actually put on our campaign page a call to action for people to be able to jump on it and actually raise awareness on it to their local MP or even the eSafety Commissioner. The hope is we can actually rally enough awareness so that people take action, address it, and we collectively as Australian citizens go, this is not what we're about. In our opinion, respect is more important than views.
What sort of community-wide response has this had via the disability community, but also the wider community?
So from the guide dogs community, straight up, people are just disgusted and have been saying to us that it's just harmful and something needs to be done now. Something that people have been saying is, you know, it really is a reflection of ignorance, unfortunately, but it's also disregard for people who are blind or have low vision. And it's not something that we should be joking about in today's age, and it's not teaching young audiences what inclusion's about. I think the people that we've been speaking to date in the social media companies and anyone else we've been speaking to, values aligned organizations, have also had the same response. So I think the most important thing here is getting that message out there more broadly so people can go, oh, that's not okay. So we can take people on the journey that this is actually something that needs to be addressed now, that this doesn't actually empower people, and that we need to create a more inclusive social media online presence.
And ideally, what kind of response would you like to see from the government in broadening protections for people with disability on social media? What sorts of implementations would you like to see?
I think there is a bit of a two-pronged approach to this. On one side of it, I think it's important that the government comes out and condemns this kind of trend so that people become aware that it isn't a trend that is acceptable. But secondly, in acknowledging the government's age restriction policy that's coming into play, I think this whole issue demonstrates that there is a need for protections against discriminatory behaviour online, and there is a need to be able to support the eSafety Commissioner in being able to hold platforms accountable when it comes to this kind of discriminative behaviour. We really need to go back to thinking about how social media is a real opportunity for connection and creativity and inclusion, and not an avenue for mocking people. And that's why it's so important that we start thinking more broadly about what we're doing online and how can we make sure we create a community that is respectful, inclusive and kind.
A spokesperson for Guide Dogs New South Wales ACT contacted Powered Media shortly after the initial story was published. The representative says that TikTok responded to the request, claiming in an email to have banned the hashtag BlindKidChallenge and removed hundreds of videos they deemed to violate their policies. They also said their enforcement action is continuing as they review content that they deem might violate their community guidelines.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
The rise of Gen Z protesters has rapidly increased in recent months, with rallies unfolding worldwide. Places like Nepal, Madagascar, and Morocco are witnessing vast incline, motivated by the younger generation's discontent with government, rising poverty and inequality. Social media and online platforms are being used to drive momentum and instigate public demonstrations. Advocacy groups have raised concerns over heavy-handed responses from authorities, which have led to serious injuries, arrests, and the fatality of some protesters. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with Dr. Aidan Ricketts, lecturer in law at the Southern Cross University, about these rising social movements.
My studies of social movements and protests are informed by complexity theory, which is a systems approach. And what you see from, say, the status quo, is that the status quo responds to pressure for change either with an adaptive response or with a resistive response. An adaptive response is where the system recognises the grievance, the behind the forces for change and adapts towards it. And resistive response is the one you're talking about, where you just batten down, tighten up and resist. So what happens when a social movement really moves against the status quo is that the status quo either makes itself fundamentally more brittle by locking itself down and becoming repressive, or it extends its existence by being more adaptive. To use historical examples, the British monarchy are a famous example of adaptiveness, which has enabled them to survive through many different historical eras. Or you look at things like the collapse of the Soviet Union and other sort of tyrannies, they tend to collapse all of a sudden.
David Meyer Canales, senior lawyer from the Human Rights Law Centre, points to the vital role of protests, especially when illustrating discontent in government and the negative impact of policy and push for social change.
What we're seeing in Nepal and even Morocco and Madagascar and other places is actually protest is really powerful. It's led to some serious government change and some serious, I suppose, national reckoning in Nepal and in other places as to who is government for and why are people not benefiting equally. I think we're seeing the power of protest. And it, in fact, I think that things don't actually substantially change without collective action. It's actually more a sign of the context that we're living in. Also, the fact that protests can actually organize quite quickly in ways that were not available before the use of social media and the internet. People are actually able to organize across borders, whereas before you had to go and literally find and talk to people and convince them of an issue. So I'm not surprised that the internet, just social media platforms and communication platforms, are actually really fueling the rise of these massive social movements in a way that we may not have seen before.
What are the similarities between the protests that are happening across the globe right now in places like Nepal, Peru, Morocco?
I think sort of fundamental thing is that people feel that they're not being listened to by governments. When people do take to the streets, they're really doing that, quite frankly, in this economy. The fact that young people are being saddled with enormous amounts of student debt and their degrees are worth less and less. This is really, really important for us to really listen to what's going on. Because people, young people in particular, are not feeling the benefits of living in a democracy, of living in this economy. And what's happening around the world should not really surprise us.
So a lot of these Gen Z protesters, they're protesting for inequality, poverty rates just being exuberantly high. And the governments have been reacting with a lot of force. What does this say about the fact that a lot of these countries, they're signatories to the UN Charter ensuring a freedom of expression and the right to protest, yet they're reacting violently?
Yeah, look, it is of huge concern. We have countries, including our own, to be honest, signing up to these big international treaties, ensuring not just the right to peaceful assembly, but the right to expression, the right to peaceful association, the right to participate in public affairs. But really, what we're seeing more and more, including in our own country and around the world, is that these rights are actually hollow in practice, even though they exist on paper. That's really, really concerning, not just for people's rights and the practice and exercise of their rights, but also what it means for democracy more broadly. Because if this is happening in a democracy, you can see how young people more and more are losing faith in democracy.
Senior lawyer from the Human Rights Law Centre, David Meyer Canales, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio. In 2023, saw a healthy baby boy brought to term and delivered via caesarean through the country's first live uterus transplant. Conducted in the Royal Hospital for Women in Sydney, the 31-year-old received donation from her 53-year-old mother after a previous hysterectomy due to hemorrhage. The procedure is one of around 40 performed in the world and represents a milestone in reproductive medicine, offering potential new options for those with uterine factor infertility. fertility. 2 years on, gynecologist and associate professor Rebecca Deans spoke with Tia Bailey to share more on her role in achievement and both the public and personal response.
In 2023, Australia witnessed its first successful birth following a uterus transplant, thanks to you and your team. What inspired you to embark on this groundbreaking research?
I met a lot of these young women and their parents at diagnosis, and they always asked me about, you know, the future and whether they could ever have children. Initially, it was only adoption and surrogacy. And then when I heard that a research protocol was being planned in Sweden, I went to visit Professor Mats Brandström in 2010. And that led me and my team to form an Australian branch of a uterus transplant research team. And we've done that and commenced our surgeries in 2023.
What an amazing journey. Could you walk us through the complexities of the surgery itself and the collaborative efforts involved?
I retain that collaboration, as I mentioned, with him and the major collaboration that needs to occur within the hospital itself. So you need to have transplant physicians, transplant surgeons. I'm a gynecologist, so that's important. Reproductive medicine specialists do the IVF before the surgery. And obviously you need engagement with the hospital and the hospital administration and ethics. And then in terms of the complexity of the surgery, so you can either do these transplant procedures using a living donor or a deceased donor. In the case of the one that was just reported through the MJA with the first live birth, that was a mother-to-daughter transplant. So the patient had lost her uterus through a massive hemorrhage, actually, after having her first child, and then so had a life-saving hysterectomy, and then was desperate to have more children and asked her mother whether she would be the donor. In terms of the surgery, the donor surgery is the bigger of the two surgeries. So you run the two operations in parallel theatres. You do the donor surgery first, where you remove the uterus and all of the blood vessels, taking them right back so that you can get good blood supply when you reattach them to the recipient. When the uterus comes out and the transplant surgeons are happy with the function of the organ, then you start the recipient surgery, which is usually 2 to 6 hours.
In terms of this specific case, if you're comfortable to share, what were the emotional responses from the recipient upon learning of the successful pregnancy and subsequent birth?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's lots of emotions with anything in reproductive health, and this is certainly no exception. She tells me that the first thing she thought after she woke up from her surgery was, oh my God, is my mum okay? And if you ever are to speak to her or read any of her posts or interviews, you know, that was on both of their minds. Like when they both woke up, they wanted to know the other was okay. And we actually nursed them in the same room, on the same ward. So they could actually, she looked straight over and could see her mum there and was just in floods of tears, knowing that her mother was fine and awake and she could have a chat with her mum. So that was the first part. Then, obviously, you have to make sure the uterus will function. So having the first period was a really, really big milestone. We were doing weekly biopsies of the cervix to check for rejection of the organ, and that's why we check for that. And we could tell that everything was going well at a cellular level, but then being able to see that the uterus was responding to the ovarian hormones and then could actually develop an endometrial lining and then have a period, that was a massive milestone. And, you know, lots of tears, and she sort of said, gosh, I never thought I'd be so happy to have a period. And then there was no reassurance like actually seeing baby Henry born. Screamed straight away, 37 weeks gestation when she had the baby, and, you know, so full term, normal size, and did really well, you know, postpartum. So I think everything's gone really well.
How does this development expand the options available for women with uterine factor infertility in Australia? Or what does this milestone signify for reproductive medicine in the country?
So I think the main thing is that this really brings hope to a lot of women with uterine factor infertility. You might lose your uterus, like our case, through a hysterectomy. You might lose it because of cancer. Or you might just have a uterus that doesn't function. And that's, you know, for some women, everything else is working, but they just can't implant that embryo. So I think what this brings to that group of patients, of which in some studies reported as little as 1 in 500 women have a uterus factor infertility, there is no doubt that there is a massive drive from this group of patients to carry a child and to have that connection. And even if they elect not to have a transplant, just to know that that could be done has really changed the lives of so many young and, you know, like all aged women in Australia.
Associate Professor Rebecca Deans speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from Amina Shakur at 4EB in Melbourne. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne. And Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.